playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. It's the story that won't go away. 2 weeks after the acquittal on all charges of four men in the Belfast rape trial, the judge lifted reporting restrictions and details of controversial legal arguments which the jury weren't allowed to hear during the trial were made public, including information that the trial could have collapsed over a tweet from a prominent politician. But it was the intervention of the former Ireland and Lions captain Willie John McBride which focused the spotlight yet again on Ulster rugby players Paddy Jackson and Stuart Olding when he suggested they should be allowed back on the pitch after they were found not guilty. Willie John McBride spoke with Sean O'Rourke.
It's all a very sad affair of a bunch of young people who, when the old saying, you know, when the alcohol's in, the common sense is out, and it's very sad that they've all got caught up in this. They've come through a very traumatic, or at least the guys have come through a very traumatic couple of months where they've virtually been tried on television every day, walking in and out of the court. They've been tried on press every day with photographs in the paper and all sorts of writings, and they've been found not guilty. And now we have some people who are saying, look, get rid of them, get them out of the way, which is totally unfair. These people are not guilty. It's time they were back playing rugby again.
You said the guys have come through a traumatic few months, and no doubt that is true. But what about the complainant? What about what she has had to endure all of this time?
Well, the complainant has had to endure it as well. She was part of it. She obviously didn't get the exposure on television and press that the guys have had. But it's sad for her as well. And, you know, these young people, all of them, are going to regret this for the rest of their lives.
I suppose in your era, Willie John, there was no such thing as WhatsApp. But, I mean, people will have a problem, I suspect, with some of the language used in that WhatsApp group, derogatory language towards women. Now, I should warn our listeners that I'm going to reference some parts of these messages that they will probably find offensive. Like, it was like a merry-go-round at the carnival, love Belfast sluts. Other messages referring to brassers. And there are some comments we just simply can't read out. I mean, that is hardly acceptable language from an Ulster or an Irish international rugby player.
Oh, I know that. And, you know, I keep going back. We've all sinned in the past. I'm not saying that we've been involved in things like that. But, you know, these are young men who have got involved in a lot of silly things. You know, as far as WhatsApp or whatever it is, I don't understand these things. And I think it's very sad and very silly that they got involved in these things. It's obviously very wrong and it's very silly.
Yeah, WhatsApp obviously long after your playing era, Willie John, but I'll tell you something that isn't new, and it's a kind of a deep-seated association with alcohol in sport and maybe rugby in particular. I mean, the evidence that Stuart Olding gave, his own intake of drink on the night in question, 8 cans of Carlsberg beer, 4 pints of Guinness, 2 gins, 5 vodka and lemonades, and 3 shots of tequila and Sambuca.
Yeah, he's some drinker. I don't honestly believe that. I think if any man took that, he wouldn't be fit to pick up.
That was the evidence he gave, though.
Yeah, it was. I find that difficult to believe, really.
Well, listener reaction was immediate as the text and Twitter machines in Studio 7 went into meltdown.
Pro rugby is a brand as well as a sport. These players are damaged goods, damaged by their own foul attitudes and language. Imagine the reaction if they ran onto a pitch. The cheek of Willie John McBride, another listener says, get him off your station. And on Twitter, Sarah Jane Murphy, Willie John McBride interview on SOR. It's not a car crash, it's a motorway pile-up on Today SOR. Then Elaine says, who is this fella on Today SOR? I'm speechless. And here's another one. Someone take the shovel off Willie John so he stops digging. And last one for now, I'm appalled at Willie John McBride's reaction to Stuart Olding's intake of drink. Yet he says that alcohol is a big problem. His flippant reaction is shocking, using the word silly and nonsense. That from Maeve.
Nolene Blackwell, CEO of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, was also critical when she spoke with Gavin Jennings.
Where do you stand in this debate?
There has to be more to it than a drunken night out, which is roughly what Willie John McBride was saying. What has happened is that some of the most prominent rugby players in this country were seen and have acknowledged the most disrespectful and derogatory behaviour towards a young woman and other young women. And there has to be a real examination of their disrespectful and derogatory behaviour in order to identify what they, as role models of people who are held up as the best in the land, would think of women, as was shown in the WhatsApp text, in ways that they themselves recognise were hurtful and harmful. It has to be looked at not just in the context of what they said on that night, but whether that is a way of operating within Ulster Rugby, within rugby, that rugby condones or allows to happen. And so we say now is the opportunity for sporting organisations to regain their great values, to ensure that we understand their high values, the way that young people are brought into the game, the way that they play the game. It's off the pitch as well as on the pitch. And here is the opportunity for all of us to grow a respect for each other, to build better understandings of how young men talk about themselves and about young women. And so therefore it's not something that can be just glossed over. And it is a shame and a pity that some people are saying it's all over, let's get on with it. That shows that we need to do work on ourselves, even if we're not involved with rugby, to make sure that we understand this is a moment where we saw what can go wrong when we fail to respect other people, but a big chance to learn as well.
Nolene Blackwell heard on Morning Ireland. Well, yesterday is another shocking story emerged, this time about a rapist on a toilet wall in a secondary school. It's obvious that public conversation about our attitude to sex needs to broaden out. Over on The Tuberty Show, Ryan's guest was Mia Doring. Her TED talk, Going Beyond Your Fear, details her experience of being raped as a 16-year-old in a Dublin park after she passed out from too much alcohol. She's now a therapist and believes that as long as non-abusive men are complacent about rape, nothing will ever change.
Rape is rape. And you talk about how people try to break it down a bit and say, well, there's
shades.
Shades. Talk to me about shades.
Shades of rape.
Or the perception of shades.
I suppose we might think of rape, the worst rape possible, as being like grabbed and raped behind a bush with the man with a knife or all the rest of it, you know. But actually 90% of rapes are committed by men that we know and presumably trust, and women are most unsafe in their own homes. So Tom Marr wrote a great blog called The Monster Myth about that, dismantling that perception we have of rapes. And it really does a big injustice to victims, because then when you say, well, I was raped in my sleep, or I was raped when I was drunk, or I don't remember it, there's a discounting of that experience.
And why is there a discounting?
I think people don't want to be uncomfortable. They don't want to feel like, oh, this is way more prevalent than I thought it was. And they don't want to feel like it could be people that we know that commit these crimes. And it's much more unsettling when it's not that.
Yes.
Stranger thing.
Let's talk a little bit about that idea that men need to talk and need to talk to each other and to their friends. As you say, as long as non-abusive men are silent and passive and complacent, nothing will ever change.
Yeah, 98% of rapists are men, and it's every day. I read every single day, I read articles about crimes that men have committed against women and girls, and it's still considered a women's issue, you know. Rape is still considered a women's issue because it happens to women. And actually, we need to look at the men that are committing the rapes. And luckily, it's starting to happen a bit more.
And the men who aren't. Isn't that part of the conversation?
The men who aren't committing the rapes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who you know, those conversations in the around the pints and
so they can
at
interject.
The match last night. And,
yeah, exactly. You know. They can interject if they see something happening. They can say something if somebody says something really gross about somebody saying something or doing something that is sexist or misogynistic, that you won't just let it go because you don't want to wreck the buzz, that you'll actually say, listen, that's not right, I'm not really into that. Or something, you know what I mean, to kind of show I'm taking a stand against this. And
your TED talk, it was a revelation. I watched it in my kitchen on Monday afternoon. I was sitting there captivated by it. So I'm really grateful to you for coming in to talk to us and not being brave at all, but simply telling your story, which is what you did.
Well, let's fight for a world where we don't have to be brave.
From the Ryan Tuberty Show on Tuesday. RTE's Big Week on the Farm returned to our television screens this week, hosted by Áine Lawler and Ella McSweeney, and it was great fun, as well as being very informative. Ray Darcy was keeping up with all the action, which took place on Gillian O'Sullivan's beautiful dairy farm overlooking Dungarvan Bay in County Waterford. Gillian originally trained as a vet before returning with her husband Neil to run the farm, which has been in her family for generations.
I believe that although you're a vet, sometimes you have to get in an outside vet because your arms aren't long enough to deliver a calf. Is that true?
So just to remind you, I did qualify as a vet, yes, and I did work in small animal practice for a number of years before turning to dairy farming, but I would have never worked in, you know, in large animal practice.
Right.
And I am 5 foot five. And when it comes to, days that I've been working on the farm here, and there was certainly one occasion that was quite a difficult calving. And there was a leg that was gone back, and I just didn't have the reach to flick it back up again. So I did have to call the vet, our local vet, Declan Gilchrist,
to give
a big shout out to him.
He's
much longer arms than I do.
Lyric FM's Marty Whelan was one of the celebs taking part in the Pull the Udder One milking contest. And he was channeling Dick Moran of Glenroe when Ray Darcy caught up with him.
Did you have a pair of wellies in the wardrobe?
I even had a pair of wellies. A whole different programme all of a sudden. Yes, I had a pair. I feel we're on playback already, Ray. But anyway, I had a pair of wellies, and I had to muck them up before I came down. So anyway, look, I'm here. I have no clue.
Right.
I saw it on the telly last night. I thought it was insane.
So isn't it? It is something else looking out there over Dungarvan Bay.
It's a beautiful place. Very hilly. I had no concept of how beautiful it would be.
Yeah.
So, and everyone's been terrific, and everybody's gone around looking like they know what they're doing, which is kind of strange for me because I'm completely out of my comfort zone. I've no idea.
Are you wearing a shirt and tie?
Do you know what I'm doing? I have a three-piece suit on me. I've got a tweed suit. I'm thinking Glenroe and Gentleman Farmer. That's the way we are out in Colester. That's out in the north side of Dublin. But when you meet the farmers, I mean, I get up at 4:30 in the morning for the show in Lyric, as you know, and you think to yourself, you know, you're up early. These guys, the work they do, astonishing, the work they do.
They're a bit like you, actually. I was talking to Gillian yesterday, and she said during the summer they can be finished at 9 o'clock, you
know, in the morning.
Yeah, it's a bit like doing a breakfast show.
Yeah, well, I finish at 10 because Lyric always gives an extra hour.
Of course. Your job is to encourage people to send in pictures and pieces of video. And
there is that, yeah. And the great thing is there's loads of children sending in their photographs of their pets and all that. I'm delighted I'm actually doing it.
And I believe that there may be a live birth.
I beg your pardon? Did you saw it last night? I thought Quentin Tarantino was directing it for bits of it last night. Right. So there is, there's rumour here of a calving.
Calving, right.
That's the hope. Right. And of course, that's a great moment here.
From the Ray Darcy Show on Thursday.
I'm pleased to announce that the two governments and the political parties of Northern Ireland have reached agreement. I've been all over the world, and I've never been any place where there are better people, more warm, more hospitable, more generous, more open than here in Northern Ireland. This is a remarkable place with remarkable people, and I hope and pray that the action we've taken today gives everyone here, especially the children, the opportunity to enjoy the kind of life that I want for my new young son.
The voice of Senator George Mitchell, President Clinton's envoy to Northern Ireland, on the 10th of April 20 years ago, as he announced the signing of the historic Good Friday Belfast Agreement, a day in Stormont when hope and history rhymed. Well, many of the key negotiators of the deal were back in Belfast to celebrate what had been achieved by the peace, but warned that it shouldn't be taken for granted. They appealed to today's political leaders to take inspiration from the compromises made 20 years ago to restore devolved government at Stormont and to work out the problems Brexit has inflicted on British-Irish relations. In her Drive Time column, Olivia O'Leary was full of hope.
When I heard a few commentators this morning saying, "Oh, Good Friday Agreement, not much to celebrate really if you look at Northern Ireland today," I just had to say, hang on here. Don't you remember what it was like? Maybe you don't. But it was like wading through blood for 30 years. I lived and worked in Belfast in 1975 and 76 when the bombing had given way to sectarian assassinations. And with each of those killings went a heartbroken family. I remember particularly fathers talking about their daughters. Magella O'Hare was a 12-year-old Catholic girl on her way to confession, shot in the back by a British soldier who said he saw a gunman. When I interviewed her father, who saw it all happen, he just kept on saying, "She was the best wee girl. She was just the best wee girl." Some years after, the IRA bombed the Remembrance Day celebration in Enniskillen, killing 11 people. Protestant draper Gordon Wilson lay under the rubble, holding his 20-year-old daughter's hand. He kept asking Mary, was she all right? The fifth time he asked her, she said, "Daddy, I love you very much." That was the last time she spoke to him. And he used almost the same words about her that Majella O'Hare's father had used. She was a great wee lassie. Last night, I acted as narrator at the Lyric Theatre in Belfast for a presentation of poems and music about the events leading up to the Good Friday Agreement organised by Poetry Ireland and the Irish government. There was a brilliant cast of actors and musicians, most of them northerners. And in the women's dressing room beforehand, there was a sharing of cosmetics and throat pastilles and laughter about the great northern diphthong as they fooled around and chanted, "How now, brown cow?" But then the performance got underway and the poems built like a funeral procession. Poems about horrific bombings, from Seamus Heaney's Casualty to James Simmons' Claudie to Evan Boland's Child of Our Time. Poems about the permanently maimed, like Janet Shepperson's Tremors. And then Paul Brady's protest poem about it all, The Island, sung memorably by Maria Doyle Kennedy. We could all of us feel the grief settling on our shoulders. And by the time Senator George Mitchell came on and asked all of those involved in the Good Friday Agreement negotiations 20 years earlier to stand up, we knew why we were applauding them, and indeed Mitchell himself. Because they helped to stop the suffocating tyranny of murder. They gave us 7,300 days, which were mostly without violence. And they created a space for peace and reconciliation. And while it hasn't happened yet as we would like it, with renewed effort and commitment, it still can. And whenever we flag, all we have to do is remember how it used to be. As John Hewitt says in his poem, Neither an Elegy Nor a Manifesto, to bear in mind these dead.
And that powerful poem, Neither an Elegy Nor a Manifesto, read here by Frances Tomalty, was also featured on Drive Time.
So I say only, bear in mind those men and lads killed in the streets, but do not differentiate between those deliberately gunned down and those caught by unaddressed bullets. Such distinctions are not relevant. Bear in mind the skipping child hit by the anonymous ricochet and the garrulous neighbours at the bar when the bomb exploded near them, the gesticulating deaf mute stilled by the soldier's rifle in the town square, and the policeman dismembered by the booby trap in the car. Patriotism has to do with keeping the country in good heart, the community ordered by justice and mercy. These will enlist loyalty and courage often, and sacrifice, sometimes even martyrdom. Bear these eventualities in mind also. They will concern you forever. But at this moment, bear in mind these dead.
John Hewitt's poem, Neither an Elegy Nor a Manifesto, heard on Monday's Drive Time with Sarah McInerney. Meanwhile, on the streets of Belfast, Paddy O'Gorman gauged the mood of both communities on the Falls and the Shankill 20 years on.
In them days, you couldn't leave your own area. It was a designated Protestant or a designated Catholic area. And then we had the Good Friday Agreement. We've seen the benefit, the fact that we can send our kids out. The kids do mix. There's integrated schools now, maybe not enough of them. Kids are now no longer afraid to leave their own road. They know they can go into the town. They know they can go into most areas. And I would say even now, unfortunately, there's still some areas where I wouldn't want my kids to go into, or possibly Catholic friends that I have, they wouldn't want their children to go into. But it's certainly better than what it was. We can go into a pub and have a pint and not worry about a gunman coming in and spraying the bar, or a bomb being thrown into it. As you know, I lost family in it, like most people in Northern Ireland.
Tear gas, but we called it. Yeah. Really bad. And then the rubber bullets, they were worse. I had a family member shot dead by a rubber bullet. Wee brother, baby brother, was shot with a rubber bullet. So that's when it all started up really bad, and we couldn't take it anymore. Yeah. We were all sent to the Free State, the army camps down in Donegal, and I was in Cork as well. We were all sent there and we had the best time of our lives. It was really good.
Are you worried that things will ever go back to being as bad as they were?
Oh, never, never, never go back to then. I'm more happier now. Like Protestants and Catholics, starting to get together and socialising together and all now.
And do you have friends from the other side?
Yes,
you do.
A load of friends. I have a daughter that's married to a Protestant fella, and I have a daughter living with a Protestant fella, and they're two of the nicest people you ever met.
Paddy O'Gorman reporting for the Today Show. Well, over on Arena, Sean Rocks and his panel were discussing how Northern artists had responded to the Troubles, and this song by Juliet Turner about the Omagh bombing captured the brokenness of it all, but also the possibility of reconciliation and healing. Broken Things, written and sung by Juliet Turner and heard on Tuesday night's Arena. Back at Queen's University in Belfast, the celebrations marking the 20th anniversary of the signing of the Good Friday Agreement were just kicking off.
Peace out, Northern Ireland. It's hard to believe it's 20 years since the Edge and I travelled to Belfast. Yeah! Peace!
Jeez, I hope to hurry up with the egg and onion sandwiches. Jeez, I'm running out of room in me bag.
You know, Betty, this week has brought me right back.
How about you?
Oh, Seamus.
Reminiscing about the old days, I see.
Aye, yeah.
Historic events.
Now, which one were you again?
He was the sort of the normal one, Bill, without the guns.
Ah, the boring one. David Trimble, as I live and breathe.
Yes. Tony Blair, you're under arrest for war crimes.
I feel the hand of history on my shoulder.
Actually, Tony, it looks like he's got you in a headlock there.
Careful. Good times. The gang's all here.
Ah, yeah. All the Good Friday heroes, the people who done all the work.
Well, apart from Mo Mullum.
And Albert Reynolds.
Martin McGuinness.
John Hume.
Well, all the people who count are here.
But it was all worthwhile, right?
Is that the time?
Wow.
I have to catch a plane to Geneva. And I better get back. I'm worried about the Roman charges.
Are you taking all those sandwiches with you, Bertie?
Are you not getting enough bread, Bill?
Oh, they were good times, but it's not the same, really, is it? Without
the drama,
the danger,
the whiff of cordite,
the government jet.
20 years, huh?
If you'd killed someone, you'd be out by now.
Right.
I had no hand, act, or
wait
part.
A second. They're bringing out another tray of sandwiches. Oh. Smells like egg and onion, lads.
From Callan's Kicks last night. Well, down south, Bob Geldof was on his own historical journey. He was talking about his great hero, W.B. Yeats, whom he believes created a vision of an Ireland we could believe in long before the rebels of 1916 messed things up.
And yet, Yeats, who you love, he's much less harsh on the men of 1916 than you are.
I would have the same sentiment, Joe, an excess of love bewildered them. He says that. And it's this vertigo of self-sacrifice, which he called it. I mean, they were messianic, hence, you know, the Easter Rising. Pierce in particular was overwhelmed with this sort of messianic religiosity. This, but then you could argue the same for Connolly. It was just a secular messianic religiosity, you know, communism. I think they were delusional. The evidence is that you resolve things by through culture and through argument and through politics. Show me a revolution that succeeded. But, you know, the point about our history for me is that centuries, like, you know, England's misfortune is Ireland's gain. Okay, you can see that, but only a gain if you have a chance of success. Otherwise, it's just symbolic. And we've had that endlessly. How many little uprisings are there against the greatest military endeavour in 2,000 years, the Romans, the British, okay? Now, a bunch of geezers rising up in Wexford is not going to do that. And a bunch in Dublin is not going to do that. And there was no way that the Irish Volunteers were going to rise up with them, no matter what delusions they had with their coup d'etat against Owen McNeill. It wasn't going to happen. So they knew it. So is it up to these people to insist on what sort of independence we have? Has it got to be their version of independence or another type? They insisted at the point of a gun it could only be theirs. And then we have a Catholic coup d'etat after that, where all the freedoms that were enjoyed prior to the rising are wiped out. So divorce is brought in, censorship is brought in, which then sends our writers off around the world. And so we're left in this sort of nullity of a culture when we had a hugely vibrant one. You know, Yeats goes into the Senate. He's not all mouth and trousers. He enacts. He's a man of action. He goes in and he rails against the divorce laws. He rails against censorship. He rails against these things in brilliant speeches. I mean, they're all in the National Library. Go and look at them. And they kind of go, yeah, whatever. Then he wins the Nobel Prize, so they can't kind of say to shut up. And he said, you know, he said, look, you won't understand any of this what I'm writing until 50 years after I'm dead. 1939, he dies. 1989, we elect Mary Robinson, a woman, a human rights lawyer, 50 years exactly to the point that Yeats said. And suddenly we're fit to go into the 21st century. We've sort of grown up. We've got rid of this nonsense that's hampered us and held us back.
Bob Geldof not holding back on Sunday with Miriam. The story of the great love affair between Catherine Earnshaw and Heathcliff in Wuthering Heights is known to every Leaving Cert student in the country. Written by Emily Bronte, we know more about the novel than its mysterious writer. Well, Sean O'Rourke was joined by Niall McMonagall to write this and to mark 200 years since her birth.
Well, her father was Irish, a Patrick Brunty or Prunty from County Down, and he was born in St. Patrick's Day in 1777. He became a teacher, he studied at Cambridge, he became a clergyman, he married a Maria Branwell, and they had six children, and the two eldest died when they were 12 and 11. But the four who survived, Charlotte, Branwell, Emily and Anne, were like no other. I mean, they were born in Thornton, a village in Yorkshire, and all four were extraordinarily talented, three novelists and one artist in the one family. Now, these four grew up in Haworth Parsonage, where their father had a living, but Branwell took to drugs and drank himself to death at 30. Both Emily and Anne died aged 29, and Charlotte died at 38. Their mother had died at 38, but Patrick Bronte buried his wife and six children, and he died in his 80s.
That's a terribly sad family history, Niall. Emily Bronte died of consumption, as it was then called. What kind of a person was she?
Well, you know, we can glean certain details about her. After she died, Charlotte said that her sister Emily was not a person of demonstrative character. In other words, she was very shy. And Charlotte also said that Emily was stronger than a man, simpler than a child. Her nature stood alone. And one of her poems begins, Sean, "No coward soul is mine," which gives you an indication of her sense of herself. She loved the Yorkshire moors, and though she worked as a governess in Halifax and spent some time in Brussels with Charlotte, she wasn't happy there. She loved where she grew up. She played the piano, she wrote poetry, she knew how to handle a gun, she baked very good bread, and the most extraordinary anecdote tells of how she was once bitten by a dog with rabies, and she took a red-hot poker and cauterised the wound herself.
Niall McMonagall with Sean O'Rourke. And that story of Emily Bronte being bitten by a dog and cauterising the wound herself came to mind when I was listening to Liveline. Jason Owens rang Joe. He was in the People's Park in Dunlera in Dublin when he came across a Staffordshire Bull Terrier attacking a small dog right beside the children's playground.
When a Staffordshire Bull Terrier latches onto a shih tzu, there's only going to be one victor there, isn't there?
Exactly, yeah. It was quite difficult. There was a few people at the scene trying to separate the dogs. The smaller dog, the Shih Tzu, was screaming, you know, course, yelping. Yeah. And it was quite traumatic, you know. And then, you know, quite a crowd had gathered, so including children in the playground itself. So it was, wasn't nice at all, you know.
So how did it end? How did anyone manage to get the bull terrier off the little Shih Tzu?
Yeah, I managed myself.
So hang on, the bull terrier had the Shih Tzu in its mouth at this stage, had its neck in its mouth.
It was suspended in the air at this stage.
Oh,
you know,
for God's sake.
It was off the ground at this stage.
People were spraying bottles of water on the bull's staff to try and...
Yeah, just to try and distract him for a second. I tried to get him to loosen his grip and nothing seemed to be working. So I went in and I was trying to hit it on the snout just with the palm of my hand. And I was holding the Shih Tzu at the same time, trying to ease the tension on its neck. That wasn't working, so I stepped back and I basically punched it in the face. I know it sounds mad. I punched it in the jaw and that loosened its grip. So both of them got separated then. And the two owners got the owner of the staff got his dog under control. A lot of people were getting angry with the staff owner because he had no muzzle on it for a start. He had it on the lead, already, but he had no muzzle. And it would have been a case of it was right outside the gate of a playground. So, I mean, I know it was bad on the dog, but it was lucky it wasn't a child.
Good point.
Well, Frances Cassidy also rang Jo. The wounded small dog belonged to her daughter.
He's very distressed. He's on medication at the moment. I think around 16 stitches.
Wow.
And all his hair is all shaved off. But he's very, very distressed.
And what's the dog's name?
Teddy.
The description there of Jason, he was being thrown around like a teddy.
And I actually wasn't there.
Yeah.
But I got a phone call and my daughter was screaming because it's a pet dog, you know?
Yeah. Were you aware of what Jason, who's on the other line, what Jason did on Sunday in
Oh, yeah. Susan actually put up a thing on Facebook about the people that were so kind. Because if that man Jason hadn't have got there, probably Teddy would have been dead.
From Liveline with Jo Duffy on Tuesday. Well, Jo himself was Ray Darcy's guest yesterday, talking about the soundtrack to his life. And he spoke about his uncle Bernard, who had a little tape recorder in the 60s. And he recently found an old tape of Jo reciting a poem at his cousin's birthday party when he was about 5 or 6.
I have Joseph here next on our list, and need I say before we start, Joseph is a hard ticket. He's a comical little genius, always up to his capers, as boys always are. But he has his serious moments too. And his contribution to this little party is We Wouldn't Change. So here's Joseph for you now with his little recitation.
We wouldn't change. Mary is tidy, Mary is neat. From the top of her head to the soles of her feet. She learns her lessons and knows her spells. She never fights and she never yells. But Tom is on tardy from Monday to Friday. And when we scrub him on Saturday night, it takes us an hour to get him right.
And who knew then that a great broadcaster was about to be born? Jo Duffy, aged about 5 or 6. Liz Nugent's latest novel, Skin Deep, has been getting rave reviews. She was Ryan Tubridy's guest last Monday.
What's your relationship with Rick Stein?
I haven't got a relationship with Rick Stein. I'm a bit devastated about that. But I met Rick Stein when Lying in Wait, second novel, got nominated for the Richard and Judy thing. They had a big party in London and I was invited to that. And I met Rick Stein and we followed each other on Twitter. He went home with a copy of the book under his oxter and I thought, oh, this is great. Rick Stein will be reading my book.
Yes.
And then I was sort of having a sort of a messing competition with Marion Keyes about who fancied Rick Stein more.
Rick Stein?
Yeah.
This is great hope for one and all. Keep going.
I know, he's 70, but he's still very attractive.
Okay.
So, so Marion Keyes and I were kind of messing with each other about how much we fancied Rick Stein. And then he blocked me on Twitter.
Why?
Maybe the flirting got a bit too much. Maybe he thought I was serious.
You're kind of at him. Well, that's funny. Congratulations on Skin Deep. I read it some time ago. Give us the elevator pitch, as they say.
Well, it opens with a middle-aged woman, down her luck, kind of desperate, posing as an English socialite on the Riviera. Gay crashes a party with a stranger, takes a load of cocaine, drinks her head off, wakes up in the morning in the horrors, on the floor, at the party. Everybody's gone home. Snotty waitress hands her jacket and says, get out. And she stumbles through the back seats of Nice back into her flat where the flies have begun to swarm and gather on the corpse that she left behind the night before.
Great. Now, that is a delightful start to our day and to your book. So where does she come from? She's very fully formed on the page.
She came from a Neil Hannon song that you played on the radio. It all comes back to you, Ryan. Yeah, you played Lady of a Certain Age by the Fine Comedy. It's probably 10 years ago. I can't remember. Gorgeous song. Beautiful song. But that song stayed with me from the first time I heard it. And I played it over and over again. And I examined the lyrics backwards and forwards. Because it's about this middle-aged woman on the Riviera who is bumming drinks off strangers and pretending that she's younger than she is. And I just was really absorbed by the song and by the lyrics.
Liz Nugent with fanboy Ryan Tuberty on Monday. This week, Facebook's founder and chief executive Mark Zuckerberg spent about 10 hours over 2 days being questioned before US congressional committees about his company's role in the Cambridge Analytica data scandal. Ryan Tuberty was all over it.
The hearings, as I say, went on for 5 hours. What headlines have we got for you? There are two senators that we like what they had to say. Here's Senator John Kennedy on the user agreement. You know this user agreement? You click here. Like, just get on with it. Here's what he has to ask Mark Zuckerberg on that.
Here's what everybody's been trying to tell you today, and I say this gently. Your user agreement sucks. You can spot me 75 IQ points. If I can figure it out, you can figure it out. The purpose of that user agreement is to cover Facebook's rear end.
Right. And then there's another piece today that tells us that you can check your own Facebook page to see if Cambridge Analytica have stolen your data. I think that's quite interesting. And as Zuckerberg is there, in typical Facebook fashion, writes the New York Post this morning, there's no simple button you can click to see if your data was stolen. Instead, you're going to get a notification and you'll see one of two posts at the top of your news feed. And depending on which post you see, you'll find out whether your data was included in the 87 million profiles swept up on behalf of Cambridge Analytica. 87 million profiles. Think about that for a second. We talked about children on YouTube yesterday. This isn't children, this is you. 87 million of you with your Facebook pages just signing away information, and little do you know. And that's why he's there. And that brings us neatly to Senator Dick Durbin and his point on privacy.
Mr. Zuckerberg, would you be comfortable sharing with us the name of the hotel you stayed in last night?
No.
If you messaged anybody this week, would you share with us the names of the people you've messaged?
Senator, no, I would probably not choose to do that publicly here.
I think that might be what this is all about. Your right to privacy, the limits of your right to privacy, and how much you give away in modern America in the name of, quote, connecting people around the world.
Think about that over the toast this morning.
And on day two, there was even more aggro when he was grilled by Californian Congresswoman Anna Eshoo as it emerged that he was among the 87 million users whose personal data had been harvested. We've all heard about gap years, but over on the Marion Finucane Show with Brendan O'Connor, the talk was of gap parenting. Phil Flynn has three sets of twins with a 17-year-old gap between the second and third set.
You have three sets of twins?
Three sets of twin girls, yes, Brendan.
The second and third set, what's the gap between them?
17 years.
Okay, and then?
Alicia and Mabby Jane are 2 and 2 months.
Right, wow. If we start with the first pair, so how old were you when you had the first set of twins?
Oh, 20, was it 27?
And then I gather you were still breastfeeding them when you got a little surprise.
So 14 months later, Tara and Emer arrived. So yeah, it was a bit of a shock, to be honest, when we went in. I was sick, I wasn't well, and I knew myself that I was pregnant, but the doctor said, no, Phil, you couldn't be. So they sent me into the hospital and then they scanned and found out I was expecting twins again.
How did you react to that?
Should we just laughed? What could you do? Yeah, just get on with it. Yeah.
So you had four babies?
Under 14 months.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So chaos? It was very busy. My mum was around that time. So mum practically moved in with us, which was a blessing because feeds ran into feeds and nights ran into days. And so the little two were on 3-hour feeds because they were premature. And then the others were just 14 months old. So, you know, there were sleepless nights and yeah, we just, to be honest, it's a blur, but the bits I can remember. My little two always say, you know, if they ever went missing, there's no photographs of them because, there'd be no photographs to advertise they're missing. And I said, well, now you understand. I didn't have time when the little two arrived that they to realise how busy it is with two when I had four. I said, I didn't have time to be taking photographs. Yeah,
yeah. yeah. And 128 nappies a week.
Yeah.
So that was some nappy bill back then, I'd say, wasn't it? Yeah.
She's some woman for one woman. Phil Flynn with Brendan O'Connor. Well, in last night's arena, Sean Rocks interviewed Viv Albertine, the former guitarist with the legendary English punk band The Slits. Viv's first book, a memoir called Clothes, 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 Music, 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 Boys, 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 was one of the most acclaimed books of 2014. And her new book, To Throw Away Unopened, is part two of those memoirs.
I think you say in the book that you've given up on both. Men, maybe people won't be too surprised at that. You've given up on music.
I have. Do you know, I can barely listen to music. It is like some, it's almost like a marriage I've had, which has been gone horribly wrong and been a huge disappointment. And it almost hurts me to listen to music. And I know it sounds extreme, but I do know of a couple of other musicians who feel the same. Incredibly sensitive to it, can barely bear to listen to music. It triggers much too much. I know you're not supposed to use the word trigger, but it is the right word. You know, it triggers pain and exhaustion and the hard work and the disappointment and my own foolishness in many ways.
But when you're talking about listening, are you talking about listening to, you know, contemporary music, music of today? Or are you even talking about listening back to music that you knew and loved in the past?
Yeah, I'm talking about silence. I like silence. I don't ever think I'll put a record on. I mean, and I couldn't live a second without music for so many years, decades. And now I can't even bear the thought of putting a record on.
Wow.
I know, it's sad.
Very sad. Viv Albertine heard on last night's arena. Routes to success are often convoluted and sometimes fascinating, but rarely as unusual as the story told to Richard Curran on The Business last Saturday. Avril Copeland is a physiotherapist who's just landed a big deal with the NHS for her healthcare management app aimed at people with cystic fibrosis. But all of this is a long way from her first foray into professional life when the honky-tonk lure of Nashville, Tennessee was impossible to resist.
It all started, to be honest, with Garth Brooks. And when I was 16, I'll never forget it, going to the, you know, the Point as it was then with my dad. But yeah, became a big fan. And to be honest, I used to sing in a traditional band as well. So I was big into music. At the same time, I was big into sport and health, but I was playing international hockey from a young age, so I never really got the points. I was never going to get the points for physio, to be honest, straight out of school. So decided, well, look, I love music, television, went to study that in DIT and then moved to Nashville when I was just 21.
What were you doing there?
So for the first year, I worked as a sound engineer in one of the big kind of recording studios there. And after that, worked for songwriters, so country music songwriters. So working with them just within Nashville and doing kind of a business role with some of the songwriters. And then I also did some tour management around the States with some of the songwriters as well. So I did love it, to be honest. I absolutely loved it. And it was such an opportunity because, like, you know, for instance, I got to meet Garth Brooks. He bought me dinner at one stage. You know, I never told him about my love for him when I was, you know, 16 years of age.
You kept the napkin, did you?
Yeah. Well, listen, it was such a highlight, I suppose, of the time there.
I hope he paid for it.
He did indeed, yeah.
Avril Copeland with Richard Curran. But I'll leave you now with the Merino Waltz from John Sheehan and Cullum McInumera. And they played live on the Ray D'Arcy Show on Wednesday. Go raibh maith agaibh as fógáil údar, go dtí an teacht an seo thugainn, go dtí sibh slán.